Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It is half the hour on Internet Standard Time. Do not adjust your dial. This is Dan Silverman, stepping in for Cheryl Dowd today, and we have begun the recording. We're happy to have everybody for another coordinator call. Van Davis, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, great. Okay, so Van, before Van gets started with his presentation here on the Notice of Proposed Rules, I want to take 10 to 12 seconds to introduce Van. He is the new policy and planning consultant for WCET, so he's a new member of the team. We're really excited to have him. Van has a lot of experience in higher ed, from faculty up to state regulatory work, and has been a consultant to the stars, and anyone who's read Van stuff or heard him talk on our previous calls knows that he knows this stuff as well as anybody. So Van, take it away.
Thanks a lot, Dan. So what I want to do is just take a few minutes to talk to you about this first set of proposed regulations that the department has put out for public comment. And you'll hear a little bit more from Christina, and then Dan's going to talk a little bit about the public comment process and when that ends. So you may remember earlier this year, we had this sort of unprecedented negotiated rulemaking process in terms of both the amount of things that the department decided to tackle in one negotiated rulemaking and how they went about doing it. If you remember, they actually, because there was so much material, they actually set up three subcommittees. And so they had folks appointed to the main negotiated rulemaking committee, which made the final decision on everything. And then they had people appointed who were subject matter experts in these three subcommittees. And you also probably remember that our very own Russ Poulin, who can't say no to negotiated rulemaking despite his best efforts, I think, was selected to serve on the innovation and accreditation subcommittee. And so it's that set of or that subset of regulations, the innovation regulations haven't come out yet, but what the department decided to do is, after they reached consensus, which I think it's fair to say none of us expected that to happen, probably not even the negotiators, the department has decided that because the amount of material is so large, that they're going to partition out the proposed regulations into three buckets. And so the first bucket that they have released has to do with accreditation and state authorization. And that's what's out right now for public comment. So I'm going to sort of hit the high points here very quickly. Russ and Dan and Cheryl, as always, have a great blog post over on the WCET Frontiers blog that really sort of breaks down the main issues on the state authorization side. Inside Higher Ed and Chronicle of Higher Ed both have some good coverage on this process in general, including on the accreditation piece. I think that there's been probably more discussion around accreditation than state authorization because there have been some concerns expressed that the proposed accreditation regulations could water down the department's oversight. And I don't feel that I'm competent to address that concern. I just want to make sure, though, that you guys know that that's out there. So real quickly, here's what the department is proposing around accreditation, the main pieces. The first big piece, and this does have a direct impact, I think, on distance education and online education, has to do about outsourcing. So you may remember that when the department put out their proposed regulations that they wanted the negotiated rulemaking committees to look at back in January, they actually were suggesting that 100% of a program be allowed to be outsourced. They scaled that back after pushback from the general public and negotiators. And so the proposed regulation now basically says that an institution can have 50% of a program outsourced without needing to do anything. If it goes over 50%, then the institution has to inform their accreditor, and the accreditor basically has this 90-day window. So it significantly increases the gate for when an institution has to go out to an accreditor, and then it also sort of puts some fences around the responsiveness of the accreditor. So that's a big proposed change that could impact online, or will most likely impact online and distance education, and especially those programs that are using OPM. There's another sort of big change in the accreditation that could impact online education, and that's changes in regulations around substantive change. The proposed regulations that the department has put out now would drop down the requirements for substantive change. So if an institution wanted to add a branch campus or wanted to increase the level of credentials that they offered, those two things would no longer trigger substantive change for accreditors. That's kind of big. Now, the branch campus piece probably isn't going to impact online education that much, but this idea that institutions would not have to automatically get substantive change approval for increasing the level of credentials actually could have some impact on online and distance education if institutions decided that they wanted to offer new credentials at levels that they don't currently offer through distance ed. So that's another sort of significant change there. There's a lot of other changes around accreditation. Those are the two that I think are probably the most important for folks that are working with online and distance education. And then the other half of the proposed regulations the department has put out for public comment have to do with authorization and reciprocity. And so there's sort of four big areas here that are worth noting. And this probably isn't going to be new for most of y'all, but I think it's, given that we're smack dab in the middle of the public comment period, it's good to sort of put these up at the top of your thinking right now. So the first one has to do with how institutions are supposed to determine the location of a student. If you remember, 2016 regulations, and this was something that WCET and SAN raised concerns about, the 2016 regulations talked about where a student is in terms of student residency. And residency can mean a lot of different things. For example, and I'm going to date myself here, and I think the statute of limitations have passed too, so I should be good. When I went to graduate school at Vanderbilt in the early 1990s, I kept my residency in Texas so I could vote for Ann Richards again. Yet I lived full-time in Nashville. And I doubt I was, now maybe my political reasons for doing that were unique, but I know I'm not the only one that did that. So what the department has done in the proposed regulations that are out for public comment is it's changed that language. It's no longer using that residency language. And instead it's using location language. And so the proposed regulations would require an institution to determine the location of a student when that student enrolls in the institution, and then have a process and policies in place for students to inform an institution if their location changes. So gets rid of the residency language, which should hopefully solve some possible confusion, and then put some requirements around when an institution determines location of a student, and then also put some of the onus on the student following through with an institution's policies regarding change in location. So that's the first sort of big piece on the authorization side. The second big piece on the authorization side is that the proposed regulations remove the 2016 language that requires institutions to document a state review process for complaints. And it removes that language because California doesn't have that process in place for institutions that it doesn't directly regulate. And that created some problems given the size of California. The third sort of big piece here on the accreditation, on the authorization and the reciprocity side, is that the proposed regs retain the 2016 language around reciprocity. And that's good news and bad news. It's great that reciprocity is retained as a viable pathway for institutions to fulfill authorization requirements. That's fantastic. You may remember that. And here again, this is great work that Russ and Cheryl and Dan have done, and then Marshall Hill over at NC Sarah. You may remember, though, that there was some confusion in the language that the department used around reciprocity, and specifically around whether or not reciprocity superseded or did not, and the department said reciprocity would not supersede a state's own regulations. And so this created some confusion about, well, if the state part of a reciprocity agreement and they decide that they're going to still sort of use their own regs, doesn't that kind of kill reciprocity? And so you may remember that one of the last things that Ted Mitchell did before he departed Department of Ed back in early January 2017 was clarify and say, no, that wasn't our intention. Our intention is to preserve reciprocity, and we see that reciprocity is something that is between a state and a reciprocity agreement / organization. And so when a state joins one of those agreements, they join knowing that they are agreeing to the regulations and the ground rules that that reciprocity agreement has in place. And this is voluntary. So if a state decides it does not want to play by those rules, then it can withdraw. Nobody's forcing a state to be a part of that. What's unfortunate here, and again, this is something that Cheryl and Russ and Dan have done a really good job of outlining in their blog post, is that there had been hopes that some of that clarification language could show up in the regulation, and it hasn't. And so that language hasn't changed. There's every indication that the department hasn't changed its interpretation from that letter that Ted Mitchell wrote. But that interpretation isn't in the regulation, and that could create some challenges in the future. And then the authorization and reciprocity section also begins to tackle notifications and disclosures. And probably the really big thing here, the two big things here. First, under the old regulations, institutions were required to notify for adverse actions. That adverse action wasn't defined. So the department now has stopped using the word adverse and instead is using some very specific language that requires institutions to notify students around investigations on academic quality, misrepresentation, and fraud. So a little bit more specificity there, a little bit more clarity. The other big piece, though, on the notification side has to do with professional licensure. And so the proposed regulations right now require institutions to disclose on the web the states that they meet requirements, licensure requirements for, states they don't meet the licensure requirements, and states they don't know if they meet licensure requirements or not. And those of you that have had to live in this world know that sometimes it's really hard to make that determination if a state meets, if an institution is going to meet the state licensure requirements. So that basic information would have to be posted on the web. There's another sort of two levels, though, of notification that are added here. One is that if a student is interested in a program, the institution has to personally notify that student if their location happens to be in one of those states where the program does not meet licensure requirements or they don't know if it meets licensure requirements. So there's another layer of personal notification. And then if a student enrolls in a program and the institution finds out it does not meet the licensure requirements, or they don't know if they no longer meet licensure requirements, they must do a direct notification to that enrolled student within 14 days of that determination. So it adds a little bit more in terms of the levels of notification that are going to be required. It also is written in such a way that this is regardless of the modality. It doesn't matter if it's face-to-face or online. I think Russ and Cheryl and Dan raise a really important point around this professional licensure notification. Notification is absolutely essential. There's no one that would disagree with that. The department, however, has probably underestimated the amount of time that it takes states to determine if they meet licensure requirements, which for smaller institutions, So for smaller institutions that don't have a lot of resources, this could be a significant drain on resources. And they also probably have underestimated the cost that's going to be associated with this. So in that WCET Frontiers blog post, Russ and Cheryl and Dan, and I would agree, my two cents here, is that these are absolutely solid, good regulations here, especially around licensure notification. But if you have concerns, you probably need to at least help the department understand the cost in time and money that may be associated with coming into compliance, especially if these are regulations that are going to go into effect on July 1st, 2020. And this is a change between those 2016 regulations that we're supposed to be operating under. So that is the really down, dirty, fast, high-level overview of what this first, as the department is calling, bucket of regulations looks like. We don't know when the next two buckets are going to come out. Those two buckets are going to be around distance ed innovation, and then the other one's going to be around religious affiliation and grant programs. So I know Dan's going to talk here in a little bit about how you can go about registering public comment, and I will shut up and let other folks smarter than me talk.
Thank you, Van. Sorry, I was having a little trouble with my mute button there. I think you did a great job there, and you drew well on your teaching experience. Does anybody have any questions for Van at this time? Okay, well, hearing none, we're going to move on to the next item on our agenda. So often when SAN programming or conferences or written works talks about SARA compliance, we think about it from the institutional perspective, the state portal entity perspective, even the NC SARA perspective, but sometimes we don't give enough time and thought to the perspective of the regional compacts. So as part of our efforts to address that, we have Christina Sedney on here today from WICHE, who handles the WSARA states and handles that role as regional compact director for the Western states. Christina, take it away.
Thanks, Dan. Can you all hear me okay?
Yep, sounds good.
Great. Well, hi, everybody. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. So as Dan mentioned, I work with WSARA, which is one of four regional entities that works on WSARA. And I actually wanted to just sort of take it up to a really high level, since regional compacts are actually quite unique and kind of interesting organizations. So sort of give a bit of a baseline about what those are and sort of why they play a role in SARA. So at the most basic level, a regional compact is really, you know, agreement among states for a specific purpose. So the regional higher education compacts, so for example, WICHE specifically, our mission is to increase access to and the excellence of higher education in the West. And so states are members, just as states are members of SARA. And that relationship with the states is really sort of the key reason that we play a role in SARA. So when SARA was first starting, in order to, you know, kind of make the case to states that SARA was important, in addition to having, you know, NC SARA, this national group, come into the states, they worked really closely with a regional compact. So that's WICHE in the West, and then we have three counterparts, as many of you know, so NEBI in the Northeast, MEC in the Midwest, and then SREB in the South. So really kind of leveraging the long-standing relationships each of the regional compact had each of the regional compacts had within their states to kind of make the case for SARA, not just again from a national perspective, but alongside an organization that really understood both the state's unique context, their unique regulatory atmosphere, and also had relationships really in many different areas. So regional compacts typically have relationships with the state's governor, with the legislature, also with the SHIO and higher education department, and then also with institutions. As you know, many regional compacts offer undergraduate exchange programs and tuition reciprocity agreements and things like that. So they tend to have relationships with institutions as well. So they have this really unique set of relationships at the state level. And so that was really critical in kind of getting SARA off the ground. I will take a moment to mention here, as I think many of you know, actually not all states are members of SARA. We still have California, so that's actually still part of my role, is bringing states on board, and that is something we're working on, and I'm happy to speak more about that later if you have any questions. And then in addition to California, the U.S. Pacific Territories and freely associated states are also WICHE members, and so should they be interested in joining SARA, we would work with them as well. And so again, the regional compacts initially kind of came onto SARA in that role to help bring states on. And then they also play a role that I think is perhaps in the background, as Dan mentioned to many of you, but in the ongoing implementation of SARA. And that's really, again, related to that relationship with states. So SARA really operates in kind of a four-tiered structure. So as you know, the institutions, you obviously are offering the distance education and you are authorized to do that by the states. And so you apply to the state to become a part of SARA. However, states actually are also authorized to become parts of SARA. So they are members of SARA. And so we are the group that works to make sure that the states are meeting the requirements that they need to be a part of SARA. And you can actually, if you go on the NC SARA website, just where they have the institutional application, you can also see they have a state application to join SARA, and you can see the specific requirements that states have to meet in order to participate in SARA. And just as institutions have to reapply every year to be a part of SARA, states actually biannually apply to maintain their membership in SARA. And so they do that through what we call regional steering committees. So the regional compacts work with representatives from each of their states, which create the steering committee, and they will review any new states applications to join SARA, and then also do the membership renewals as well. And so the goal there is to make sure that, you know, we certainly understand that every state is different in terms of its regulatory capacity, and then also, you know, how they do things in the state, the resources they have available, but we want each state to be comfortable with every state in SARA's processes. And so that's why we have the state group every other year, renewing states' practices. The Regional Steering Committee also serves a couple other key purposes. They help to provide a forum for states to provide feedback to NC SARA. As you know, it's sort of institutions and states who are really sort of doing all that on the groundwork. And so that's who, we'll really see if there are any practice issues related to NC SARA policies. And so that's sort of a forum for us to collect those. And then finally, it's an area for us to really foster regional collaboration. So, you know, say we have a state that does a really good job handling student complaints via SARA, so we can have them share their practices with other states as well. So the steering committee offers that ability as well. And so we think that's really important. So again, not something that's necessarily, you know, something that would pop up a lot in your day-to-day, but that's sort of what's going on behind the scenes at the state level from the regional perspective. And so I'm happy to take any questions if you have them.
Well, Christina, I have a question related to what you just said at the end there about how it doesn't necessarily, the regional compact's role doesn't necessarily pop up on the day-to-day. But are there examples of a question that you would like to hear more of from the institution, or do you ever get something where you say, well, that should have gone to your state, or that should have gone to NC SARA? You know, how is the dialogue going between the institution level and the compact level in your limited time in this job?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. So there are a couple, and actually I would say you probably don't want to be in a situation where you're working directly with us, although you can be. The two situations where that would most likely to be happening would be if your institution is put on provisional approval to join NCSARA, the regional compact staff, so myself or WSARA, needs to sign off on that. And so you'd be working with us in that situation, potentially, although always through the state. We try in everything we do at the regional level to make sure it's in conjunction with the states, rather than, you know, working around the state. So everything we do with an institution, we will also include the state portal entity as well. And then also if a state portal, if an institution applies to join SARA, and then they are not approved by the state portal entity and they have concerns about how the state portal entity applied SARA processes, they can bring that concern to the regional compact as well. So that there is that method of interaction as well. On that said, we're always, you know, you can feel free to reach out. We're always happy to talk. I think many of you know that NCSARA are the ones who are responsible for setting SARA policy. And so, you know, that's not the role of the regional compact. Ours is just to ensure states are meeting SARA policy. So any sort of overall policy questions would go to NCSARA.
Great. Christina, I don't know if you can see in the chat, we have a question about regional compacts working with the Department of Ed. Are you able to see that?
Oh, yes. I would say, well, we're in a little bit of a unique situation, which I think, as you know, because we have WCET, I would say WCHE itself does less in terms of direct interaction with the Department of Ed, but WCET does a fair amount. And so Russ Poulin is both the executive director of WCET, but also WCHE's vice president. And so I would say our primary interaction with the Department of Education is via WCET, who I believe they do look to as a trusted and guiding voice, and now also the SAN network as well.
That's a good reminder as our invoices are coming due. Thank you, Christina. Any other questions for her? I have one more. What in your relatively short time so far doing this job, it's been a few months now, I think, what has surprised you the most?
I think perhaps and this shouldn't have been a surprise, given that SARA itself is relatively new, you know, it's only been around for a few years, but I would say just the breadth of questions that come up, you think you sort of understand everything and every possible scenario that could occur, and then there's always a scenario you never anticipated that can occur. So it's really that, you know, we're all learning how to work through these processes together, and whether that's, you know, Marshall Hill at NCSARA, Russ at WCET, you know, you could be the most experienced state authorization person in the world, but situations can still come up that stump everybody. And so we have to kind of work through them together, and I think so that has sort of been the surprise, but I've also been really encouraged, I would say, by how willing I think everybody that I've worked with thus far has been to really jump in and try and work with the best interests of the students at heart. And so that's been really encouraging to me.
Great, thank you for your time. Does anybody have any other questions for Christina? Let's see, it looks like there's one more. Oh, okay. So Mary Larson is, well, you guys can all read the chat. So that's not a question necessarily, but she's just reiterating that SARA welcomes questions about SARA, which NCSARA does, which is of course true. Okay, so thank you, Christina. We will now move on here. I'm gonna talk a little bit about the comment period. One thing that was a little unusual about the comment period this time is it was only a 30-day comment period. Typically, the department will go 90 or at the shorter end, 60 days. And 30 days is just really short. So I know it can be a little tough for everybody to get their comment together that quickly. Here at WCET SAN, we're almost done with ours, but we haven't quite finished ours yet either. And obviously with July 4th coming up, you know, I know I'm going to be making daily trips to the fireworks store and all that. So, you know, it really is going to be crunch time here. I think that the blog that we wrote that Van referred to so graciously is a good template if you're looking for some things about issues to comment on and some possible perspectives to take. But of course, you guys have a lot of knowledge on the ground that will be really useful as well. As far as the mechanics of commenting, I posted those into the chat, and it's also linked on in the blog post that's also linked on the chat. But the simplest way to do it is through the portal that the department sets up. If you don't want to do that, your best bet is going to be snail mail. You can't email or sadly fax your comments in. So again, the portal is the way to go. There's instructions there on how to do it. I think we're hoping to share our comment with the membership before we submit it. But again, it's taking longer than I think we were. I don't know if it's taking longer than we're anticipating, but it is taking a little bit of time to get that done. So I wouldn't wait for us if you are planning to comment beyond what we put into the blog post. Are there any questions about the comment? I'm having a little trouble. Oh, Yolanda asks if there was a reason behind unusually short comment period. None that was given. Some people think that it's just because they don't really want to hear comments as much this time. Maybe that's a reflection of having reached consensus. Maybe they thought that there wouldn't be as many comments or questions. I'm not sure. But either way, it is a little bit unusual. And Van, you guys can all read the chat. Could be because there are still other buckets to come. Yes, that's an excellent point as well. So if anybody has any other questions on commenting, another decision, I guess, that you will have to make as an institutional staff member is whether you want to do it, your comment individually or on behalf of your institution. Obviously, it can be a lot trickier on the political side of your institution to comment from the perspective of your institution. When I was in an institutional level, I commented a couple times. And both times did so as an individual. I didn't even bother trying to work with our government relations office or anything like that. But as Russ is fond of reminding us, the volume of comments does matter. So we would encourage you. And when I did it, it was partly thought it would matter, but partly it was just kind of an exercise for me and advocacy and getting my thoughts together and trying to be somewhat persuasive or insightful. And anyway, I think it's in other words, it can be a professional development thing too, if nothing else. Okay, next section here. We did not have any volunteers for this contribution of something you've learned recently. I did cry for a few hours, but I always stay hydrated, so my tears were easily replenished, and we'll do it next time or not. The Sand Podcast. Okay, so I posted that in the chat as well. The first one, the June edition, has been recorded and posted. We will be doing one in July and one in August. We don't know exactly what the format for the July one is going to be yet, but we encourage you to give it a listen. I guess a good podcast host would say, give us a 5-star rating, but we're not on any of those platforms right now. So you just mentally give us a 5-star rating. But any feedback you have, let us know. We want it to get better. As far as the announcements go, a couple of quick things. The Advanced Topics Workshop has sold out, so I should probably take it off this. That just happened this morning. Registration is open for the WCET annual meeting. There is a SAN coordinator meeting the day before the annual meeting starts. A lot of you have come to that. There's no charge for that, and you can attend that without registering for the WCET meeting if you would like. But, you know, if you're going to go all the way out there to Denver, assuming it's a trip, you might as well stick around, get a little insights from the other WCET areas. That's just my pitch. And open forum. In July will be about the Higher Ed Act, which could get reauthorized at some point and kind of change this field again. So we will, unless anybody has any other questions or concerns, anything that I missed. All right. Well, that is all I have for today. Thank you all for your time, and have a great rest of your week.
Bye.